It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, cause the bebop stork was about to arrive, mama gave birth to the hand jive. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And here on this show, where we often talk about robotics and the future of machines replacing us, helping us, mostly replacing us.
We sometimes
have to take stock of the things that still fall under the category of humans can definitely do them better than machines.
Right. Until recently, one of those things was playing the game Go.
Oh, not anymore.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Yeah,
it has joined chess and checkers in the field of
tic-tac-toe.
Games. Tic-tac-toe. Yeah, the computers are so totally better than humans.
Thermonuclear war.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in the movie War Games, it's definitive.
You know, when I said tic-tac-toe, I think what I meant was Connect Four. Now, that is a solved game that computers can always beat us in, but I'm pretty sure they can at least force a draw or
in tic-tac-toe.
Yeah. Yes.
But anyway, yeah, so always doing better than us. Of course, they can drive cars better than us. That's been clearly demonstrated now.
Yeah, with one crash out of... one crash caused by a robotic car out of all the ones that have actually, you know, all the miles and miles, millions of miles driven by robotic cars.
I think even that one's kind of questionable. You're talking about where it went, where it got hit by the bus when
yeah.
it was trying to merge.
Well, I mean, Google themselves said, you know, that they accepted responsibility for that.
It was a partial at fault.
It was a little bit of a backhanded acceptance because they said, we just anticipated that the bus driver would slow down.
They were like, well, if the bus had been not a jerk.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that. One thing I remember coming across a couple of years ago, I think, is that even now computers are even better at reading micro expressions on human faces than humans are.
Yeah. So, you know, they can tell when someone's disgusted or bored or whatever better than we can.
Yeah.
I have encountered humans that I know clearly
lacked some of that ability where I'm like, I can't get out of this conversation no matter what I do.
You have to actually tell them explicitly, stop talking to me.
Yeah, I've also been guilty of doing that.
So. I just carry around plasma grenades, and when I'm done with a conversation, I just stick it right to their face. Nice. And go, bye!
I was just going with the ninja smoke bombs. Just poof, and then run. Yeah.
You know, for a while, the robots were pretty bad at walking on uneven surfaces, but they're even closing the gap on that, those Boston Dynamics bots.
Although, if you watch that DARPA Grand Challenge, where it had the sequence of tasks that the robots had to be able to complete, we saw that robots still find certain tasks really challenging.
Especially bipedal ones.
Yes, like opening a door and walking through it.
Well, bipedal is a terrible system for anyone to use.
Yeah.
Even our own spines are really meant to be like crawly spines.
No, they're meant to sit in front of a computer all day.
Oh, okay.
I sure hope so, because that's kind of what I'm doing.
No, it's true. One of the biggest problems left for machines is dexterity.
Right.
Yeah.
Diverse object manipulation on the small scale.
Mm-hmm.
So you deal with this skill every day. You use it all the time, handling various objects, especially delicate objects, with precision. One definition that comes from some researchers that we're going to cite later in the episode puts dexterity as, quote, many independently controlled degrees of freedom, speed, strength, and compliance. I think that pretty well summarizes it. It's what you do with your hands to get all the different jobs you need to do done without crushing everything you touch in the process.
Or injuring yourself.
Yeah.
For example, we can use our hands to manipulate all sorts of different objects pretty readily, even if we haven't come into contact with them before, just through the experimentation of touching the object, and then you get a feel for what the object is like. You kind of get an idea immediately how much pressure should you use when picking up the object. When it's something squishy like a banana, you know not to squeeze so hard that it squirts out both ends.
Right.
But also if it's like a prickly sweet gum ball or something, you realize those points, like if you use too much pressure, you're going to hurt yourself, and you know to be gentle with it. And you also get a feel immediately how heavy that object is, so you know how much force to use when lifting. These are things that are intuitive to us, but robots don't have intuition, except they kind of can if you go with machine learning, but we'll get to that.
Yes, I think that is well said, Jonathan. So think about it this way. When you pick up a banana,
yes,
and then peel that banana, and then pick up a knife with your other hand, and then slice that banana over a bowl of cereal, this may be a simple action to you, but this is horrifying warlock magic to robots.
Right.
We have nothing even close to being able to do this unless there's a robot that has been painstakingly, explicitly programmed specifically for this task.
Which I haven't heard of, if there is.
And if there is, it makes you wonder what better things people could have done with their time rather than training a robot to slice a banana into cereal.
Yeah, I mean, there is that crab bisque robot, but...
Yes, that's true.
That's a kind of good example of the idea of explicit programming versus a sort of generalist adaptable programming.
Right.
But gentle, variable, dexterous, and deft control of objects in the hands, that's just something that robots are not at yet. And another thing is that watching video of robots trying to achieve this is often really funny.
So funny.
Now, I watched one recently where they weren't very advanced robotic hands. They were actually... pretty simple clamps.
Clamps?
They're clamps.
Clamps.
Were they?
Yeah, it was essentially a two-pronged kind of hand, right?
Like, mm-hmm. like clamp.
It's just clamp, yeah. And but it had a box full of different objects, and the robotic arms, or the hands rather, were quote-unquote learning how to pick up those different objects, and they would attempt to pick up an object and start to learn from trial and error how that was not working properly or what did work properly, and it would try to replicate that in a future attempt. And it was a box full of tons of different stuff, like staplers, and it was mostly office equipment type stuff, staplers and tape and that kind of thing. And they were supposed to pick up the staplers. And so for a while, you know, they're just kind of fumbling around, trying to find the best way to get a grip on the staplers, and eventually started to figure it out pretty quickly. Then they started to go with more advanced approaches, which the hands were learning on their own. They were actually developing these techniques on their own where they would knock an object that they didn't want out of the way in order to be able to get a grip on the object they did want. So it's kind of like, you know, a human where you see a pile of stuff and the thing you want is under something else. You just kind of move the thing on top in order to get it to the thing that you actually want. And it was fascinating to watch. It was very funny because at the beginning, it was just chaos,
yeah.
Right? It's just robot hands going everywhere in this box of stuff.
It's like the hands in that office simulator game you
yes.
kept talking about.
Yeah, just throwing things randomly in different directions. Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, now we're criticizing the current dexterity of robot hands.
Mm-hmm.
But you might be thinking, wait a second, now I thought that there were industrial robot arms and so forth, all kinds of robotic effectors that carry out very precise jobs like machining, assembly and manipulation jobs.
And they do.
Yeah, they certainly do. But these robots have been explicitly programmed for a very specific job that they do over and over again. It's worth the time for somebody to figure out exactly what motions they need to make and teach them how to do that, because they're going to be doing the same thing maybe for the rest of their lives, or at least for one long production run.
Right. It's the idea of using a robot instead of a human for those jobs that have really tedious replicated work that you have to do.
Yeah, adding a single part to a larger thing over and over and over again.
Right, or welding a door to a car frame, that
sure.
kind of stuff. Where, you know, it's something that would be dull or dangerous or dirty. That's the three D's that we often get for the kind of jobs that robots are best suited for.
Right.
And as long as it is a task that is going to be exactly the same time after time, you don't have to worry as much about the general dexterity. You just have to make it really good at specific movements.
Yeah, one thing that it does. And so an industrial robot might be able to, for example, place a ball bearing in a machine slot with precision over and over again. But if you try to get that same robot arm with its same end effector to open up a ketchup packet or something, well, let's see how well it does.
End effector, by the way, is the industry term for thing at the end of a robot arm.
Yeah, it's the part of the robot that the robot uses to interact with the world. So this could be like a welding torch, a drill, a puncturing stylus, a suction cup, a claw, a clamp, or maybe a hand, a humanoid hand with
sure.
five fingers. But hey, you might also be thinking, now, didn't you guys talk in the past about robotic surgeons and how these surgical robots could give surgeons really incredible precision in laparoscopic procedures reaching into the body?
And they do.
Yeah, that is also true with precision cutting, sutures, and a lot, tiny, tiny little movements. There is precision in these robotic tools, but a couple of things. Number one, they're controlled by humans.
Right.
So what they do is they translate large movements of a controller's hands into very tiny, precise movements in reality.
And this is something that anyone who's used a computer in the last 30 years has had experience with, because your mouse does the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you move a mouse, you're moving it it's kind of the opposite side.
Yeah.
That's the same principle, but in opposite, right?
Inverted scale of movement.
Exactly.
You move
the mouse a little bit, and the arrow will move a greater amount on your screen, because if you had to move the mouse exactly the same distance as the cursor needs to travel, you would need a really big desk.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's the same principle, just in reverse.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And also the robots in these cases, they have a limited number of objects and tools they're designed to interact with. And as we said, it's directly controlled by a human operator. So it's not the same thing
right.
as needing a robot that has the kind of dexterity of a human hand. Now, some robots can achieve more variable motion, not by having a really, really powerfully generalist end effector like a human hand, but just being able to, like, switch out tools, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Just sort of like a plug-and-play kind of option of, like, well, I need a clamp for this and I need a blowtorch for that. I'm not going to put a blowtorch on the clamp. I'm going to switch out my robot and end effector hand.
So clearly it's like Dustin Hoffman's hook in the movie of the same name, where he could switch the hook out.
What are his other hooks?
He has one that is a double cigarette holder.
Oh, right, right. Yeah,
and he has one that's a magnifying glass.
Ah.
Yeah.
Does he have one that's a hand mirror?
He might have had, yeah, he did have one that was a mirror. You're right. Yeah, it's when he's being attended to by Smee.
Coiffed.
Yeah, where his mustache is being perfectly curled. I can respect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, okay, but same yeah. sort of thing.
Well, anyway, so we've discussed all the reasons that robots generally just have a very specific type of end effector that's for the job they do. But why would you maybe need a robot to have something more like a human hand?
Well, Joe, let me run this by you. We humans, we've been around. The stuff that we've built for ourselves for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And we humans, many of us have hands. And uh-huh. so the stuff we have built has been meant for creatures that have hands, and therefore the world that we interact with, particularly the man-made portion of that world, is really hand-centric. So if you want to interact with that world, hands are pretty much where it's at.
So what you're saying is that asking a robot to move around in the human world is unbearably cruel and frustrating.
If that robot does not have hands and you need it to do things that hands would come in really handy,
mm-hmm.
yes. Like if you ask a Roomba to open a door, I'm sorry, that's yeah. just not happening.
Trying to get clamps to rake the yard for you, it's going to have a hard time.
Yeah. I mean, here's the funny thing is that as a left-hander, I encounter a tiny percentage of the frustration that if a robot could feel it, it certainly would feel in a world that is made for people who are predominantly right-hand dominant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I have this little experience where when I want to interact with tools, I need to use certain things. Sometimes it is counterintuitive and difficult, and sometimes even in the case of chainsaws, dangerous for a left-hander to wield. And so you sit there and think, well, I actually have hands. It's just that I'm dominant with my left hand, not my right hand.
Uh-huh.
For robots that don't have hands, then these problems are magnified by orders of magnitude.
Yeah, so the robots that exist today with very specific end effectors are not really a problem because they don't come into our world.
Right.
They're not supposed to be able to do all the things we do. But people project that in the future, maybe in the next couple of decades, we're going to start introducing robots that are not the specialists that robots have always been, but they're generalists, and they're not segregated from us in the mm-hmm. way robots have always been. They're integrated into our lives. They live with us, and they do the same kinds of jobs we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so for exactly the reason you point out, these robots need to be able to touch the same things we touch and touch them in the same way, manipulate them in the same way.
Right.
To be able to handle the stuff we handle without smashing it or dropping it or not knowing what to do with it.
Yeah. Otherwise, you end up having to redesign all the tools, right? You'd have to redesign the tools for the robots, which seems like that would be a whole lot more work, depending on how tricky it is to really get a good set of robotic hands.
Yeah.
Also, I want to point out, I'm so sad that our listeners can't watch this podcast because we are just naturally gesturing with our hands a whole bunch.
All over the place.
Which we do a lot to begin with.
That's
really.
True. Yeah.
I do make a lot of crab claw motions in general in most podcasts.
That's also true.
With little clamps. Yeah. But another thing. So one of the things is that we want generalist robots rather than specialist robots to be able to integrate into our lives in the future. But the mm-hmm. other one is just that the human hand is an amazingly, remarkably powerful machine.
Sure.
It's a miracle of nature. It can be adapted to so many different jobs. And this isn't just because it's natural. I mean, I'm not saying any biological version of an end effector would be able to do this, because think about a crab's claw or an ant's forelimbs. They can't do all the things that the primate hand can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's the primate hand specifically that's so amazingly powerful. It can push, pull, punch, pinch, slap, climb, throw, place things deftly. I mean, it can do thousands of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it can do all these things with objects of vastly varying size, weight, and shape.
The minimum, roboticists say, that you need to approximate a human hand's gripping and manipulation capacity is 9 degrees of freedom. That's 3 fingers capable of moving in a 3-dimensional space. Yeah?
Oh, yeah. And I feel like I've seen robotic hands that are basically 3 fingers.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. It looks a little bit like a nightcrawler hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. But a fully functional hand is a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, the human hand has more than 20 independent degrees of freedom. I think I've seen somebody say 27 somewhere. That might be a disputable number, but definitely more than 20. And it's controlled by more than 30 muscles, which in robotics terms would be actuators.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, and so when you think about something that complex, now let's be fair. The human hand has had the benefit of millions of years of evolution to lead to that approach, right?
Robotic hands, on the other hand, have had a few decades.
Right. So we are trying to replicate what took nature millions of years to create.
Right.
And so we shouldn't be so, not skeptical, but so dismissive of how quote-unquote primitive robotic hands are right now, because honestly, they're getting to be pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And also, I did want to point out that, you know, just because the human hand works so well for us doesn't necessarily mean that it's the only design that we can come up with that can do this kind of amazing stuff.
There's
some really cool generalist end effectors that are being designed that look nothing like a human hand. I wanted to mention one as sort of as an example of how advanced they can be, yet still fail to match our hand's design ultimately. I think we've mentioned this type on the show before. It's based on jamming transition technology. And okay, in physics, jamming is what happens when granular materials that would usually flow, like a sand or sugar or coffee grounds or whatever, they become rigid when they're like really packed in.
Mm.
Yeah, like if you've ever handled a package of vacuum sealed coffee grounds,
oh yeah,
it's a brick.
Uh-huh.
It's solid, completely solid. But if you open it up, you can pour the grounds into your coffee maker. Sand flows through hourglasses. But in a hacky sack, it becomes a solid, bouncy unit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that I think this is the second mention of hacky sacks we've had in this episode so far.
Good times.
I think we actually mentioned hacky sacks before we started
before
recording.
Before we started? Okay.
But it's okay because it's always in our hearts. And sometimes on our knees and feet.
Jonathan, were you a high school hacky sack player?
I am not answering that question, Joe. Please go on, Lauren.
No problem, Jonathan. So a jamming transition, which is the jamming transition technology, is the word I used before, term I used before. A jamming transition occurs when grains of stuff become dense enough to act as a solid. And this, as it turns out, is a really useful property, because researchers figured out that if you fill a soft rubber ball with a granular material and then attach that rubber ball to the end of a vacuum tube, you can quickly and easily move air into and out of the ball, thus changing the density and the behavior of the material inside.
Huh.
And you can use such a device to grip and handle objects of all kinds of different shapes and sizes, because they mold to it. And then, like if you've got a Lego brick, the ball can bend around the top of the brick or the top of a bottle cap and solidify around it in order to pick it up. Then it can soften again to put it down.
This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. You might have seen one, the bright green VersaBall. It looks like a weird little tennis ball on the end of a tube. And about a year or two ago, I think, there were a lot of videos going around.
Interesting.
About it. But yeah, it's great. It's really fascinating and beautiful to watch in action. Also, it can't play a piano at all.
Right.
It would suck at that.
What's amazing to me is that this actually reminds me of, I saw a comedy show. It was an improvised comedy show. And one of the characters in the show was a robot that had become horrified that Ed had killed his best friend, because did not realize that humans can't reboot.
Uh-huh.
And so had replaced these hands. He would say that over and over in the episode.
Uh-huh.
He replaced his hands with oven mitts filled with cookie dough, what he described it. So that way he could no longer hurt anything. It would just flop against people.
Aww.
And it was hilarious and heartbreaking at the same time. So when you're describing this, I'm like, I can't believe that incredibly weird improvised comedy thing I saw 15 years ago is kind of sort of the same thing you're talking about.
Except
cookie dough, it would be some sort of granular type stuff.
Sure.
But that's amazing. And weird.
Truly, yeah. Improvers are the future thinkers.
I guess.
The Jules Verne of today.
Yeah. I'll have to let him know. I know the guy who did it, so I'll have to tell him, hey, you were prescient in your goofy make-em-ups.
Some people who have been working with robot hands even earlier than this improv team of yours.
Yes.
Was it with Dad's Garage?
Yes, it was. Of course
ask.
It was. It's Christian Danley with Dad's Garage.
You guys, if you're ever in Atlanta or if you're from Atlanta, you should totally check out the work that Dad's Garage does. It's a terrific theater company.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so even before Dad's Garage, yeah, people were working on robot hands. And if we were going to go into the full history of this, the history of the development and the technology, that would be a whole episode unto itself.
It'd probably be a couple.
And
yeah,
maybe we should do that on tech stuff sometime.
That might be a great idea. Yeah, sure. Since we've got some of the research right here, that would be a great foundation for a tech stuff episode.
But I did want to mention a few of the particularly like key or interesting stories from the very beginning days of the development of this kind of stuff.
Cool.
So as far as I can tell, the first electrical mechanical five-fingered hand is from 1962.
I bet that was a horror.
it wasn't a full robot. It was so beautifully designed that it wasn't such a horror as you would imagine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It was intended to be a prosthesis, and it's called the Belgrade hand. It was designed by a biomedical engineer by the name of Reiko Tomovic and an electrical engineer by the name of Miodrag Rokic at the University of Belgrade. Hence the name, the Belgrade hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that I'm not... I looked up the pronunciation of these names, but I don't know Serbian, so I might still be totally mangling them.
It's way better than any time I ever say anyone's name in whatever language. So I think you have acquitted yourself with honor.
Excellent. There's actually a lot of really beautiful images of their design because a couple years back, an artist by the name of... Alexandra Demonovic, yes. She built a digital model of the Belgrade hand and then casted a whole bunch of copies for a gallery show she did called The Future Was at Her Fingertips.
Wow.
Anyway, the Belgrade hand had five touch-sensitive fingers that were controlled by a single motor so that when any finger pad came into contact with an object, all the fingers closed until the pressure on each pad was just about equal, thereby hypothetically gripping the object.
Interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah. But not a robot. It was, you know, a reactionary machine piece.
Gotcha.
The first truly, like, programmable hand was a three-fingered device created in 1983 in a collaboration by Stanford University and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, thus called the Stanford JPL hand. The lead designer was this fascinating guy, J. Kenneth Salisbury Jr., who's a mechanical engineer who specializes in both computer science and surgical anatomy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is diverse interests.
I know. I love it. And the Stanford JPL hand had three joints on each finger for 9 total degrees of freedom with its, again, like kind of like Nightcrawler hands.
Gotcha.
And its motions were controlled by electric motors that were attached to tendons within the fingers. But perhaps the most famous device from this general era was created in 1985. It was a four-fingered hand from the University of Utah and MIT, thus called the Utah MIT hand. And each finger on it had 4 joints for a total of 16 degrees of freedom. And its motions were pneumatically driven.
Wait, 4 joints? That's more than real fingers have, right?
Yeah.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. 2, 3. Yes.
Yeah.
More. Yeah. So it looks.
And not only are we gesturing with our hands, we're referring to them.
Sitting here and staring at them.
Let me physically count the joints on my hand.
Usually it's only on the weekends when I'm just staring at my hands. But today I feel like we're really making progress toward that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fingers were sort of like long and spidery. It actually reminds me of like a skeletal version of like Mr. Burns' hands on The Simpsons.
Oh, right.
It's got the 3 fingers and
yeah.
And a thumb. And so, the kind of most advanced of the bunch was released in 1988 or debuted in 1988, because there were a couple different models of it, out of the University of Southern California and the University of Novi Sad at Belgrade. And that's called the Belgrade USC hand. It's based on the design of that original 1960s Belgrade hand.
Mm.
So it had a rotating thumb with 2 joints and fingers with 3 joints each for a total of 15 degrees of freedom. And unlike these previous examples, the joints were not independently controlled. They kind of took a cue from that Belgrade hand and also from actual human fingers, because you can independently move each finger, but all of the joints on each finger are kind of attached to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, movement wise. So, so if a knuckle joint moved on this Belgrade USC hand, it would trigger the other joints on that finger to move as well.
Right, to sort of curl in. Yeah.
To curl
in. Again, we're looking at our hands and playing with them.
Well, it's just try to just curl in your pinky.
Yeah,
can
I can't
you
do that.
It?
I can't do it.
Your other finger comes with it. Your ring finger.
Yeah, not at all.
Like that's I'm showing something to people who can't even see this. It's just Joe and Lauren who get a
this
chance.
Is working so well for radio. But
yeah,
when I curl
in my pinky, my ring finger is almost as curled in, and then my other two fingers curl in as well for me because I can't. Now Lauren is able to turn her pinkies in much more capably than I can.
I noticed I was able to just pull my pinky in after I forced it down with my other hand.
That's cheating. That's cheating. But there are some robot hands that can do that where each finger can independently move with that full freedom. This approach, however, was more like a human hand in that you had those connections between the various fingers.
Right. So it was a little bit more naturalistic and probably energy saving as a result.
Interesting.
And these few that I've just mentioned were kind of the standards that everyone referred to for a number of years. It wasn't really until the late 90s that a whole slew of research projects involving robotic hands started going into development again. The tech was kind of booming at that time.
Sure.
And also the size and cost of computers was really starting to actively shrink.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, of course, research has continued. I know one private company that has been a big name in robotic hands, or at least five-fingered robotic hands in the past decade or so, has been the Shadow Robot Company out of London.
Which doesn't sound terrifying at all, right?
But they've got this product called the Shadow Dextrous Hand. And when I was looking at research that was ongoing at, like, university labs with robotic hands, a lot of them seem to be basing their models off of the Shadow Hand making modifications to it and stuff.
Right. The Shadow Hand itself is commercially available, so you can buy one. They do not say how much it costs.
I wonder why not.
You send an inquiry and find out. General rule of thumb, if you have to ask, it's too much for you to pay.
Yeah.
But it is a really fascinating piece of technology.
I know a Shadow, now I don't know exactly how much their product came through in the final version, but they were involved in the creation of the Moly Chef robot.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right,
okay.
Which is the one about those disembodied hands that make the crab bisque that Lauren was talking about earlier.
Yeah. So it's got hands reaching around the stoves, you know, adding ingredients and stirring stuff. And we know that the Shadow Robot Company had something to do with contributing technology to that.
Right. So the hand that they make, this dextrous hand, has 20 degrees of freedom, so similar to a human hand, 24 joints total, and the fingers and thumb are all capable of motion, and it can also flex its palm, similar to what our hands do near the little finger when we close our fist. So when you close your fist, you see that there's a little bit of a fold right below your pinky. That this hand also does that. So it's not just an independent joint where the pinky just folds down over the palm of the hand. The palm itself
can
bend.
And the palm doesn't move at all. Right. The palm moves in this case.
Exactly.
Huh. Okay.
So it has 129 sensors. So pretty advanced, right? It provides telemetry data, and it makes the hand useful for developing manipulation control systems. So you might end up getting a hand like this if you are actually working on the back end software side of things to control the hardware. Each joint also has absolute position sensing, and each actuator has force sensing, so that way you can get really specific with the way the robotic hand handles whatever objects you're planning on making it handle. The fingertips have other sensors in them as well that can sense tactile sensations, so in other words, rough versus smooth, that kind of thing. Also temperature, so it knows if something is hot or cold. These are things that we take for granted as human beings, but robots don't just automatically know that. If a robot hasn't been programmed to sense temperature and react to it in some way, if you had a robotic hand and it came into contact with something too hot for the robotic hand to stand up to for any length of time, it would just get destroyed. It would be melted or burn. So it's a very clever thing that they added. Also, it can detect current and voltage.
You know,
working with electronic systems and being able to detect, you know, whether or not current is flowing, something that you don't mind a robot doing, but you probably mind if a person's doing it. If you're a decent person, you mind if a person's doing it because you, depending on the amount of voltage and current, you might have some pretty big safety issues on your hands. And so really a cool piece of technology. And, you know, Joe, you wrote the script for the video episode that we did about robotic hands, mm-hmm. which I don't know when this podcast goes live. I have no idea if that video will have published yet or not, because I don't know what the publication schedule for our videos are. So you might be getting a preview right now, mm-hmm. but it was really neat to look into this and see the design and see how it moves. And I was really impressed by it.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to add is, you might think, all right, so what are these robotic hands for? I mean, they're not attached to a robot.
Yeah.
It's disembodied hand. So some of it is teleoperation, that idea of mm-hmm. being able to control a robotic hand with a human controller to operate something that you might not want to be in the area for, like you're handling toxic materials, for example. But another one is, you could actually use this to outfit a robot with these robotic hands. So if your robot has big old hooks at the end of its arms and you're like, finally, the hands have come in.
Right.
You can rip the hooks out, dump the hands on.
Congratulations, clamps. You're getting some fingers.
Right.
Yeah. So the shadow hand, like we said, has been involved in, like it's been used as a model for some university research. And one university that I have seen plenty of interesting robotic hand research associated with is the University of Washington. And a couple of researchers who have been associated with the University of Washington earlier this year, there was a cool piece in the IEEE Spectrum about them creating this biomimetic hand that was trying to take the five-fingered hand approach to make it more like the skeletal and muscular structure of a real human hand.
And they went to great lengths to make sure that they could do that. It's super cool the way they did it. Also, depending on your point of view, maybe a little creepy.
Yeah.
So, you know, our normal robotic hands, which is a weird sentence, way to start a sentence,
just
right?
Regular old robotic
hands. But your traditional robotic hand, it's trying to mimic what a human hand can do, and might be somewhat based upon the structure of a human hand, but we have to take a lot of liberties, right? Like using hinges or gimbals in order to replicate a joint, for example.
And it's not going to have bones like your hand.
Right. And it also might mean that the motion that you get out of such a hand is not truly representative of what a human hand does, or what it can do, or what it cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes important when you want a robot to be able to interact with our human world, right? Mm-hmm. You want the robot to be able to do essentially the same sort of things a human can do, and avoid the stuff that humans can't do because it's irrelevant within the human world, unless it's something that ends up being useful.
Yeah.
Right. So they decided that instead of just using these hinges and gimbals, they wanted to take a different approach. So they took a dead person's hand, a cadaver, a skeleton from a cadaver, actually, a skeletal mm-hmm. hand. And then they scanned it with a laser scanner. So they got a really accurate scan of the bones in a human hand, and then they used a 3D printer to replicate that by printing out artificial bones.
Yeah.
Now, this meant that the joints where the finger segments all meet together, they are exactly the way human joints are. Mm. So it doesn't have the mechanical element of like a hinge or a gimbal.
So instead of like a screw or something like that, you actually need ligaments.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just a ball and socket, correct?
Right, yeah. It'll just fall apart. It won't do anything. So they use artificial ligaments. They also talked about it was particularly useful for the thumbs, because the thumb joints are a little more advanced in a way, mm-hmm. you could say, than the finger joints are. Mm-hmm. The base of the thumb, you can do a lot more motion than just bending it down. Again, we're looking at our hands and playing with them. This is great. I can't wait till we do the episode on feet. And then we're all like, this was a terrible idea. So
what is the future of robot feet?
Nobody cares.
Just wait. We're going to get a request now.
Okay.
So the muscles in the hand are simulated by 10 Dynamixel servos.
Okay.
And so they're using mechanical servos to pull the cables that mm-hmm. are replicating the muscles.
Like tension, tendons.
Yeah, and that controls whether the fingers are open or closed and the various motions of the hand. And they actually route the cable in a way that is similar to the carpal tunnel of your wrist and hand. So
maybe this robotic hand could get carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, you know, if it actually worked long enough, then you would imagine that those cables would eventually wear out. Uh-huh. And so you would have to do some surgery on it. I doubt it would have to wear a brace afterward, but you might end up
getting it. Unless you programmed it to feel pain.
Right. Yeah. Which, I mean, come on. That's got to be on the list.
But that's a funny thing to point out because it does highlight another possible use for an extremely accurate replication of a human hand with a robot, which would be hands used for medical research.
Yes.
Like if you wanted to use a robotic hand in some kind of futuristic setting, maybe as a scaffolding for regrowing regenerative tissue or as a model for replacing a human hand, like Luke Skywalker in Empire Strikes Back,
right.
giving mm-hmm. somebody a fully functional robotic hand. Now we have some hand prostheses today that are sort of referred to as robotic hands, but they're not quite as functional as mm-hmm. a real hand would
sure.
be.
Right. And they, in fact, have said that that was their intent, to create a platform that could be used in such a way. Also, you can control this hand using a Waldo. And I just wanted to bring that in because it's one of those terms that you've probably heard if you've ever worked with puppetry. The puppeteers who are using electronic puppets often use a Waldo to control them. Essentially, that's a remote manipulator, and it's named after a character from a short story from a Robert A. Heinlein piece.
Really?
Waldo, who the guy named Waldo creates a device that does this thing.
Huh.
So when people finally did create a device that does this thing, they named it after the fictional
Aww.
One. So it allows for teleoperation. So in puppetry, this would allow you to do something like move Hoggle's mouth in Labyrinth so that the actor inside the Hoggle suit isn't also having to manipulate some other control to make the mouth move that's actually being controlled by a puppeteer off screen. In this case, you would be wearing essentially like a glove with sensors on it. So when you started moving your fingers, it would detect the motions and then translate that into commands that the robotic hand would follow.
Hmm.
And it would mimic the motions that you make with your hand with just a slight delay. So it's a little eerie to watch, but also really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we mentioned that research was associated with the University of Washington, but there's some more that we want to point to. For example, there was one group of researchers who in May of 2016, they're presenting a conference. I think the presentation hasn't actually happened yet on the day we're recording this, but the paper's been released online. Presenting a conference paper called Optimal Control with Learned Local Models, Application to Dexterous Manipulation. And this is research about machine learning for programming robotic hands. Now, they're working off of a sort of modified shadow hand model that they came up with. They actually detailed this in an earlier conference presentation paper. So in the earlier paper, they bought a shadow hand robotic hand to use for testing advanced control schemes that they were trying to come up with in their robotic hand movement laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
But they did some testing and they found that the actuation wasn't fast enough for the dexterous object manipulation they were going for. So in this first paper, they describe essentially a pneumatic actuation system to improve the design, to make it faster. And they emphasized that their goal was not to build new hardware for its own sake, but sort of in furtherance of designing newer, better control schemes for robotic hands.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the deal with the control schemes? Well, this team of engineers and computer scientists from University of Washington, a couple of the same as that previous paper, they designed a system for robotic manipulation that can learn tricks of dexterity from experience.
Huh.
And that was that paper title I mentioned. So the lead author, Vikesh Kumar, he's a doctoral student at the University of Washington studying computer science and engineering. And he explained the context for his paper by saying, quote, "Hand manipulation is one of the hardest problems that roboticists have to solve. A lot of robots today have pretty capable arms, but the hand is as simple as a suction cup or maybe a claw or a gripper." So they're on our frequency, claws, grippers. Yeah.
Right. Not clamps, but
never a clamp.
There may be wisdom in a clamp, but it can't twirl a baton. So the goal was to advance a control scheme to create dexterous movements for a pneumatically actuated, so that's pneumatic movements, you know, air pressure,
mm-hmm.
Tendon-driven 24 degree of freedom robotic hand. So this is building off hardware ideas that they established in the previous research. And this thing would have 40 tendons, 24 joints, and more than 130 sensors. Because even if you have a great robotic hand with fast, nimble hardware and good feedback sensors and all that stuff, how does it know what to do? Right? Think about the way you reach out with your hand and pick up a grape and then toss the grape into your mouth, if you can do that. Can you guys do that?
I would probably hit myself in the eyeball.
I practice sometimes, and it's harder than it looks. They make it look easy in the cartoons. But anyway, it's not just one motion. There is a series of probably hundreds of individual muscle contractions and micro motions to do this one task that seems really fluid and simple at the macro level. But imagine if you're programming a robot hand to do the same thing. Would you literally want to have to figure out how to explicitly program what every single muscle equivalent actuator has to do at every moment in this action?
I wouldn't.
Yeah. So one of the authors on the paper, the senior author and lab director, Imo Todorov, he was quoted in a University of Washington press release explaining this. So he says, quote, "Usually people look at motion and try to determine what exactly needs to happen. The pinky needs to move that way. So we'll put some rules in and try it. And if something doesn't work, oh, the middle finger moved too much and the pen tilted. We'll try another rule." So he compares many robotic manipulation systems essentially to an animated film. And I like this comparison because it looks great, but that's because it's been meticulously specified by programmers in advance. And this system, on the other hand, the one they're coming up with and describing in this new paper, is more independent.
Which is important if you want a generalist robot that can interact within a human environment. Obviously, you don't want to have to program every single conceivable interaction this robot might have, because you know you're never going to be able to do that.
Yeah, you can't. It's like a – that would be an exhausting choose-your-own-adventure.
It could be one where you send the robot out and you're like, guys, we did great work today. Did anyone remember what to tell the robot to do if it ever picks up a knife? Oh, get it back!
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that if we want to have good generalist robots with like a humanoid range of hand motions – we're going to have to go the machine learning route. I have a hard time imagining how all of the motions of such a machine could be explicitly programmed. That seems to me almost like trying to imagine a natural language chatbot that has all of its conversation explicitly programmed. It's just ridiculous.
Right.
You couldn't do it. It's probably not quite on that level, but seems close.
Yeah.
But anyway, so what did they do? Well, the University of Washington team has a computer simulation of the hand that can analyze its movements in real time, and this can help teach the robot hand how to improve its motions through machine learning. Their term is reinforcement learning, or RL. Mm-hmm. And in the paper, they describe their RL algorithm. It is vastly complex, and I don't understand a bit of it, but it's online if you want to go check it out yourself. But they use this optimized control strategies for the hand to use it to reach target poses and to manipulate a cylindrical object. And Jonathan, what is that cylindrical object?
It's a plastic tube filled with coffee beans.
Not sure why they picked full of coffee beans, but I like it.
Yeah, they're probably on hand, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't think they I didn't find anywhere in the paper where they described why coffee beans, unless I missed it.
Yeah, but can't put my finger on it.
Yeah, but anyway.
Apparently the very first jamming transition ball was also a balloon filled with ground coffee.
Wow.
I think just scientists like coffee.
Oh, yeah. They just have a lot on
hand. Have some.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be a study on it.
But anyway, there's a video demonstration they put online where they gave the robot a task. And what it is twirling an elongated tube of coffee beans in its hand. And it's using machine learning algorithms to work in steps to slowly teach itself how to rotate this object in its palm. So it sort of starts with it laying across the palm, and it's trying to move its fingers to twist it out like a baton that it's handing off to you.
Yeah, I watched this video, and I got to be honest with you. When it got to the point where it reached the success rate, I wasn't entirely sure at what point did we pass the fail. But I will say that it makes sense that this is complicated, because you think about it, it's a tube that's filled with – it's not packed. It's not completely packed with – so stuff can shift.
So the weight shifts
exactly
as you move it.
Yeah. So it is trickier than what it sounds like upon – when you first hear it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it seems easy for you because it's intuitive because you've already done that, not machine learning, but your equivalent, the bio learning throughout your early years, learning how to manipulate objects.
I've been twirling tubes of coffee beans for decades.
Yeah, but if you watch a toddler try to manipulate objects,
it's hilarious.
With their hands.
Yeah,
they'll drop stuff. They don't know how to do it, right? watching babies trying to feed themselves, they can't operate the objects yet, the fork or anything like that.
I feel the same way every time I try to eat a salad because like the leaves are all different sizes and I cannot put them in my face.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm terrible at humaning.
I got it. I understand entirely.
You must be getting bad salads.
They're great salads. They're just randomly sized.
Just so you get that wedge salad and you just look at it and you're like, my arch nemesis, we meet again.
At any rate, I do find it really fascinating that they're focusing on pneumatics for this research, mm-hmm. as opposed to the electrical motors as mm-hmm. actuators, which I think have been more so the standard. Like historically speaking, it was an outlier. A couple of outliers that were pneumatic. And so it's cool that technology is coming around again.
Yeah, if you watch these hands go through all their degrees of motion, like doing all the different joint movements as mm-hmm. fast as they can, it's pretty funny. It's like just fingers slamming back and forth. And
yeah, you hear a lot of clacking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wouldn't that be a great scene in a horror movie like this? So there's a mad robot with humanoid hands coming for you, and you just hear the clacking fingers Ooh. Clacking up and down.
Or another great scene, you see what you had presumed to be a human character this whole time just lift up their hand and then go through that sequence super fast, and you're like, all right, that's not a person.
Right.
No human can do that.
So one last thing about this method that they came up with and the hand that they're using is that it's expensive at this point. So it's not cost effective for their method to be sort of exported for industrial use or something.
Right,
right now it's a research model. Mm-hmm. So what they're saying is it's to improve core robotics principles.
Right.
And so what they're trying to do is come up with control schemes, mm-hmm. systems for designing control for hands of this kind. And hopefully their research in conjunction with other types of research along these lines going on around the world can help sort of build up a robotic control scheme consensus that will allow us to have better, smarter control of objects, even with the good hardware we have today.
Yeah. So
not even with applying to the good hardware we have today.
So we can think of it as like primary research in that field as opposed to heading toward a finished product.
Yeah.
Which it's still really interesting. And we're in the early days. I'm excited to see where that goes. I mean, think about some of the applications we could put a really advanced robotic hand toward.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's the obvious one of robotic prosthetics, which we've seen some of, like we've got the Luke arm, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've seen some pretty impressive improvements in that space, but we're still lagging well behind what humans have evolved into over those millions of years. But that's clearly one use case for robotic hands as we get them more, as they become more similar to the ones that we have.
Yeah.
But there are other ones we could use too. I mean, like you mentioned, the using it actually not to replace a hand, but perhaps as a platform upon which you could study and research and develop regenerative medical procedures.
Yeah, sure. Regenerative tissues. I mean, that's going to be, I think, a burgeoning field in future years.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see where this goes, right? Whether or not we do see more generalist robots enter into the scene. Because as we pointed out, the hands are just one aspect of how tricky it is mm-hmm. to design a robot that is capable of moving through the human world as adeptly as we do.
Well, let's be clear. There is absolutely not even close to such a thing as a good generalist robot today.
Right.
It doesn't exist.
So it may very well be that within our lifetimes, we don't really see a strong generalist robot. It may be that we see a lot of specialized robots
mm-hmm.
like the Roomba, things that were designed to do specific jobs and nothing else. And it may be that that's just the status quo for several decades.
Then again, I wonder if you might have a specialist robot that may still need humanoid hands. For example, if let's say we fully commit to the chef robot thing.
Oh, sure.
Like Molly, you know, with hands doing stuff all over the kitchen. And we say it, now it's not just adding ingredients and stirring. It's also doing all the chopping and the peeling and the washing.
The prep work. And all that stuff.
And it's got to be able to handle all our foods, handle all the kitchen utensils. In that case, I would think, well, maybe even though this is to some degree a specialist robot, it needs humanoid hands.
Right. Sure. Or if you were going to make a robot to change baby's diapers.
Sure.
I guess so.
I like that that's the example you went with as opposed to something I'm seeing in our notes right now for the first time. Robots designed for choking and strangling, Joe?
I just put that in there for a laugh.
Okay, that's fair. All right, but yeah, we definitely think that the work, the advancement...
Strangle
in...
with a clamp. Please go ahead.
That's fair. So if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking...
You can email clamps@howstuffworks.com.
We will not get that email, but you can do that. Or you could actually send it to fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, and we will get that one. Or you can leave us a message on Twitter or Facebook. We are FW Thinking on Twitter. Just search FW Thinking on Facebook. Our profile will pop up. You can leave us a message there. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters. Every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.